this is much worse. So we have those people whom their ultimate desire is this world, and the only thing that they care about is having a fancy, extravagant life for themselves.
Yes.
They don't care about the spirituality or good life. Mm-hmm. But still, because they are living in a, you know, religious society or community, yes, or because they are being somehow blamed by they feel guilty,
yes,
because, you know, they feel guilty and they know that they are right. They use the name of religion in order to justify themselves, or in order even to in order to calm themselves down.
Yeah.
And but at the end of the day, if they refer back to their own, if they reflect on it, they know that they are doing something which is not proper.
Yeah, I mean, the religion sometimes, said Mohsen Naqvi, is decorated with the money that is taken out of the religion itself. I could vividly remember when this tower was going to be built in the Saudi Arabia, just right across from the Holy House of the Kaaba.
Right.
And the pictures were out.
Crown Tower.
Yeah.
The King's Tower.
The King's Tower, okay? So the main question was that when this simple cube is going to attract the people, so what is this tower doing over here?
Yeah.
I mean, spending the money that is taken out of the religion, but not for the religion, but for materialistic usage. This is not only, I mean, limited to Saudi Arabia. We could see it in other Muslim lands that, unfortunately, this we can say a luxurious lifestyle,
yes,
is getting into, and luxurious lifestyle sometimes when you give it the religious color,
exactly,
and religious decoration, it
to
becomes
something
very
which is
much
not
dangerous. It,
yeah,
becomes very much dangerous.
Exactly.
Because the people that are doing there, for sure, they are not doing it for the sake of religion. And the, yeah, people who are attracted to it are not, for,
yeah,
sure, attracted for the sake of religion, but for the money that is around it. Do you have any criticism on that, brother?
Well, obviously, it is said, al-amr bayn al-amrayn.
Okay.
You need to choose the medium way,
yeah,
the mediative way.
The moderate way.
The moderate way. We have a verse in the Quran, even regarding what we spend in the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which is known as infaq.
Mm-hmm.
And Allah is talking about those people who does infaq, who spend in the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, who does charity. Who are they? Allah says in chapter Furqan, verse 67, that وَالَّذِينَ إِذَا أَنْفَقُوا لَمْ يُصْرِفُوا وَلَمْ يَقْتُرُوا وَكَانَ بَيْنَ ذَلِكَ قَوَامًا. Which means that those who basically spend in the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala or does charity, they neither waste, like they spend a lot of the money,
yes,
into the charity, nor they keep like a lot and spend some of the money.
Uh-huh.
But وَكَانَ بَيْنَ ذَلِكَ قَوَامًا. But surely they are basically, and the just means is ever between these two. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is clearly saying this into the Quran as well, that a mu'min, a believer, is the one who choose the middle way, the moderate way, not going to the extreme and not being like, not even spending even a penny on this cause.
Yes.
The things that we see in the religion is because that we have this hadith as well in the Nahjul Balagha. Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam has also mentioned about this, that the people, they live their life without the religion, and then in order to show that they are religious, for example, mm-hmm, or they're the Muslims or religious, they add religion up to the amount of the salt that we add in our food.
That is a spice.
Yeah, the spice,
okay,
in order to have some taste of the religion.
But
for example, we
know that the religion is the food itself, not the spice.
The religion is actually food.
Okay.
And then this entertainment should be, yeah, up to the amount of the spice or the salt that we should have.
Nice distinction that there is there. Religion as the food or the spice,
yes,
of the life.
Exactly.
But it's the other way around.
Okay.
And the problem is, for example, if I can give example, like our youth or the people in the West, usually they go to the parties. They do not, for example, do hijab, or for the boys,
yes,
even, they do not have their own hijab as well. Obviously, the man should have the veil of
haya,
the eyes,
the haya,
and all
right,
those.
The chastity, that's
the
right.
The chastity and everything. We,
okay,
don't see these things in the youth.
Okay.
But on the other side, in order to show that they are religious and they're Muslims, they just pray. Or,
okay,
for example, they fast in the month of Ramadan.
Mm-hmm.
In order to just show that they're also religious. For example, whenever it comes to the ladies,
yes,
all the boys, they say like hijab is wajib on the ladies.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's on the others, basically. We,
okay,
try to apply religion on others, not
others.
Ourselves.
Oh, very good.
Very that's good. Another issue.
Very good case.
That whenever you try to apply things on the others and you think that religion is something for others,
not
me,
themselves. That's right.
Not okay. me. That's the problem where mm-hmm. we see these things are happening. And if we today see, like, for example, these two towers that you said next to the Kaaba, the people go to the Kaaba in order to get near to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
And obviously, they don't have these worldly desires. They're not after worldly desires when they go to the Kaaba.
If it was so, Prophet Muhammad did not break the idols, brother,
The Prophet himself was against this system of kings. And the
idolatry, king system, monarchy system,
the monetary system.
Yes,
obviously he was against it.
Yes,
and the system that has been introduced by the Islam and the Quran is the system of Imam and Ummah. It's the system of leader and the nation, the followers of a leader.
Yes,
and this leader should be living according to the standards that a medium or the lower people that they're living, and that's what we see in the life of the Prophet as well. That the Prophet's lifestyle, his house, his clothes, and Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam was according to the lower level of the people.
Thank you very much, Sayyid Mosenawi. Dr. Zazadeh, anything to add, brother?
I just wanted to mention just one very short thing about what you said about the reason behind these things.
Yes.
You know, doing something bad and giving it a good name, mm-hmm. just like coloring it with the name of religion or any other good thing, is a type of hypocrisy. And, you know, it is much worse than doing something bad without trying to color it with something good. And this is why hypocrisy is much worse than unbelief.
Mm-hmm.
In the Quran, hypocrites have been given the harshest, warnings. And they will be punished in the worst possible way on the Day of Judgment. Because not only they are doing the bad thing, but also they are defacing the religion and they are the religion of God, and they have a much worse influence on the minds of other people about the religion
That's
of
right.
God.
Okay.
And this is what makes it even worse, because there may be some people who really want to know the truth and they want to follow the religion of God, but when they see that some people who are being called religious, Muslims or whatever, they are having those types of lifestyles that everyone knows that these are not proper, they will be misguided.
Then they will rely on the other sources.
They will be misguided. And this misguidance and actually misleading people will be written on the on the shoulders of those people who are doing those things. And so the danger and the risk of those people who are doing these things is much worse than even unfaithful people.
So according to Imam Musa Asad, religion of Islam is for life, but not getting to the extremes or being excessive or mask, we can say, the consumption of all the resources around us. So we are doing, and sometimes I think that we are spending this world, you know, and we want to get to the end of this world in order to finish it and get to the other world sooner, so that what's happening over there. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala keeps his blessings and na'amat and all his mercies in this world, but in the proper, moderate way.
Absolutely.
As you both, dear experts, believe in that. Thank you very much, Dr. Zazadeh.
You're very welcome.
Very nice elaboration, Sayyid Mohsen Nahwi. Thank you very much. And dear listeners of iRab English Radio, thank you very much again for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. Please visit our website, parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also our YouTube page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant fact
Imamat yek asl zinda ast dar tarikh Islam
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Muhammad Ali Javdan. Please stay tuned.
داستان داره در مورد شیخ انصاری رضوان الله علیه.
There is a story about Sheikh Al-Ansari and the patience that he had in difficult situations. Once the wife of Sheikh got sick, it was near the end of the month and Sheikh had no money left to spend for treatment of his wife. Now, we all know that Sheikh Al-Ansari was in charge of the house of his time and he was responsible for the payment of the monthly salaries to the clerics of the Hausa. He could easily pick the money from the fund box of the Hausa and spend it, and then lend it back at the start of the next month. However, he considered himself the same as others, and did not consider for himself a special share. This was the time when he could borrow money from the fund box of the Hausa, which he himself was its owner, and then put the money back in its place without anyone knowing it. Sheikh Al-Ansari thought to himself and told himself, I must not do this because I don't know what will happen to me till tomorrow. Maybe I die and remain indebted to the Hausa and others. This is how the great men of Allah show patience in difficult situations. People like Sheikh Al-Ansari are concerned even about the most trivial points in their lives. The reward for such people, as Allah promised, is surely heaven. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Muhammad Ali Jafdan. To find out more about this program and our other programs, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
The world body has to stop releasing statement after statement condemning the Zionist regime and its apartheid policies, and instead take decisive actions to hold the usurper regime and its Western supporters to account. This has to include an international legal push and resolution that forces the Israeli regime and its Western allies to end the occupation of Palestine and allow people there, including Jews, Christians, and Muslims, decide their future government through a national referendum. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the Safa Fars News Agency published under the heading, Is UN Condemnation Enough for Zionist Regime? Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Once again, the United Nations has expressed concerns for the Zionist regime of Israel's decision to advance construction in an illegal Jewish settlement in occupied East Al-Quds that would make establishing a contiguous Palestinian state even harder, reiterating that settlement construction is illegal under international law. Nikolai Mladenov, the UN envoy to the West Asia region peace process, says, if built, it would further consolidate a ring of settlements between Al-Quds and Beit Lahm in occupied West Bank. It would significantly damage prospects for a future contiguous Palestinian state and for achieving a negotiated two-state solution based on 1967 lines with Al-Quds as the capital of both states. Settlement construction is illegal under international law, and I call on the authorities to reverse this step, he added. Another instance and proof that a Palestinian approach based on compromise for the sake of a two-state solution never works, and yet another piece of evidence to prove that the Palestinian Authority and Fatah movement's recent shift to join the resistance movements of Hamas and Islamic Jihad has been an appropriate move and a correct policy. The Palestinian Authority and the European Union's foreign policy chief have also criticized the Israeli regime's move, The PA sought a future independent state that includes East Al-Quds and the West Bank. Territories occupied by the Zionist regime in 1967 war and viewed the settlements as a major obstacle to peace. With nearly 500,000 illegal settlers now living in the West Bank and more than 220,000 in the occupied East Al-Quds, the PA has now come to realize that the chances of establishing their state have evaporated, meaning that the precious time they have wasted on the negotiating table with the Zionists has only served the Israelis to encroach forward without even a war with the PA. Much of Al-Quds is already blocked off from the West Bank by a series of checkpoints and a separation barrier built by the Zionist regime. In other words, UN condemnation is not enough to stop the usurper regime from building more illegal settlements on Palestinian lands. The same argument could be made about the UN condemnation of the Israeli blockade on Gaza. Just because the world body also condemns the criminal siege, it doesn't mean that the Israeli regime would now lift the blockade and allow the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine refugees in the Near East run schools and provide health services as well as other humanitarian aid to the Strip and an estimated 5.7 million Palestinians with refugee status. Gaza, with a population of 2 million, has been under a hermetic Israeli siege since 2006, when the Palestinian group Hamas won the democratic legislative elections in occupied Palestine. Since then, the Zionist regime of Israel has carried out numerous bombing campaigns and several major wars that resulted in the death of thousands of people. This only makes the UN's work ever more difficult. The world body has to stop releasing statement after statement condemning the Zionist regime of Israel and its apartheid policies, and instead take decisive actions to hold the usurper regime and its Western supporters to account. This has to include an international legal push and resolution that forces the Israeli regime and its Western allies to end the occupation of Palestine and allow people there, including Jews, Christians, and Muslims, decide their future government through a national referendum. An international push as such should hold the fake Israeli regime accountable for fundamental violations of international law during decades of occupation and terror, which is the longest-lasting military occupation in the modern world and shows no signs of ending. The criminal regime has crossed many red lines into illegality, and this has paved the way for international legal processes to be triggered and the occupation to be ended. As per international law, the laws of occupation are very clear that the Israeli regime cannot treat the territory as its own, nor can it make claims of sovereignty. Yet, this has been its pattern of governing the occupied Palestinian territory for most of its 72 years of reign of terror. The Zionist regime has also been in non-compliance with more than 40 resolutions of the UN Security Council and with more than 100 resolutions of the General Assembly, thanks largely to the diplomatic support by the United States of America and its duped Arab allies in the West Asia region. These anti-Palestine regimes are the reasons why Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu keeps telling the international civil society that Al-Quds will be part of the Israeli regime forever, no more Jewish settlements will be uprooted, and the Israeli regime will stay permanently in the Jordan Valley in any peace agreement. Indeed, the time has come for the UN and the rest of civil society to compel the Zionist regime and its allies to end the occupation and give Palestinians the right to self-determination if they are serious in their condemnation that the Israeli regime's role as the occupying power is illegal. The world community also stands to win if it triggers the relevant international legal processes to stop construction of illegal settlements on Palestinian lands. After all, this is also what the International Court of Justice regarding the legality of the occupation and settlements has said. The court is absolutely clear that the Israeli regime settlements expansion as well as wall on and through the occupied Palestinian territory are condemnable and contrary to international law.
A successful hit deep inside Saudi Arabia. Yemen's Ansarullah fighters carried out a retaliatory missile strike on an oil facility in the Saudi port city of Jeddah on Monday. The Yemeni army says a new winged missile called the Quds 2 was used in the operation against the distribution station operated by Saudi Aramco. Yemen's military spokesman Yahya Sari said it was another response to the Saudi-led aggression against Yemen. The military spokesman warned Saudis and foreign companies operating in the kingdom to stay away from vital installations, as he pledged that Yemeni fighters will keep up such retaliatory operations. The new Quds 2 cruise missile must have flown over 400 miles to reach its target. The latest missile strike once again underscores Ansarullah's fast improving capabilities to hit Saudi targets with high precision.
This strike on Aramco's site should certainly let the Saudi kingdom know that this is not a war it can win. It has shown, it has attempted for years to defeat the Yemeni people and has not succeeded, and they're only getting stronger.
Ansarullah's arsenal of new weapons, including projectiles and drones, has become a major headache for the Saudis nearly 6 years after they began the war to defeat the popular forces. The Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the de facto ruler of the kingdom and the architect of the war, has been under pressure to find a way to end the failing, protracted military campaign. None of the strategic goals of the invasion have been fulfilled after all these years. But bin Salman's close ties with the U.S. President Donald Trump, mainly based on huge American arms sales, have allowed him to keep the war going. Will the Saudi prince take the increasing power of Yemeni forces seriously and change direction? The Saudi-led war in Yemen began in March 2015. It will be the sixth anniversary of the war in just a few months. The war in Yemen has been described by many as a forgotten war. The onslaught has been rarely covered by mainstream media. Even when Saudi airstrikes hit markets, weddings, schools, or hospitals, killing large numbers of civilians, the war got little attention in Western news channels. The situation has long been the world's worst humanitarian disaster. As the Yemenis suffered, the business-minded president of the United States took the opportunity to seal massive arms deals with the Saudis. The kingdom has been free to buy anything from America, from fighter jets to command and control system and advanced battle tanks and warships. The U.S. is a partner in this aggression. The U.S. military support for the Saudis and their Emirati allies also includes mid-air refueling, providing intelligence and logistics. The incumbent U.S. president will probably leave the White House soon. How will his successor Joe Biden act on Yemen? Saudi Arabia has a very powerful lobby in Washington, and the kingdom's petrodollars have proven irresistible to American politicians and decision makers for many decades.
It's unlikely there'll be any change. The U.S. is always happy to foment and encourage a disruption and disorder and chaos anywhere in the Middle East. And because Saudi Arabia is such a large buyer of U.S. weaponry, the United States government under Biden or Trump or anybody else will not want to see those profits diminish.
Biden faces tough choices over Yemen and his ties with the regime of Saudi Arabia, as he will probably need to make very important decisions soon.
The Naval Fleet of Iran Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has recently received a new domestically built ocean-going warship capable of carrying aircraft, drones, and missile defense systems. The heavyweight multipurpose vessel, which has been designed for long sea journeys, joined the IRGC's Navy during a ceremony on Thursday. The 4,000-ton warship, which is 150 meters long and 22 meters wide, can carry drones, helicopters, and operational vessels, as well as missile, air defense, and radar systems. It is named Shahid Rudaki Warship after martyred IRGC Navy Commander Abdullah Rudaki. The vessel is equipped with three-dimensional phased array radars, surface-to-surface and surface-to-air missiles, advanced communication systems for electronic warfare, and a Khordad 3 air defense system, all of which are designed and put into operation by Iranian experts.
The main issue for the armed forces is to be strong enough to defend the country and to retaliate any possible attack against Iran. So that is part of that. And since we have the Persian Gulf and actually the Caspian Sea in south and north of Iran, it has been very important to have a good and powerful navy.
Rear Admiral Alireza Tangsiri, commander of Iran's IRGC Navy, said the vessel can carry out combat, logistical, and intelligence-gathering missions in the ocean aimed at establishing stable security in maritime transportation lines and providing assistance to the commercial and fishing fleets belonging to the Islamic Republic and regional countries. U.S. President Donald Trump's new acting defense secretary, Christopher Miller, said last week that Washington will be cutting the number of its deployed troops to Afghanistan and Iraq to 5,000 from 7,500 forces that are currently present there. Just days later, however, the U.S. Central Command said in a statement that two B-52 bombers were deployed to West Asia on short notice to deter what it called potential aggression and reassure U.S. partners and allies in the region. That comes after the New York Times said in a report that Trump had asked his close allies what options were available to take action against Iran's main nuclear site at Natanz. The report adds that the advisors warned the president that a military action could spark a broader conflict in the region.
There have been times that Iran and the United States have been much closer to a war between themselves. So it's not a tough situation right now. The tension is high to some extent, but it's not that high that we would be worried about any possible war. But the United States know that it's not capable of attacking Iran and doing a war, because we have seen for 20 years the situation in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and the United States was not capable of fighting against those countries completely, and we were introduced to endless wars because of those two countries. So let alone the Iran, which is actually much more powerful and much bigger than those countries.
Some experts are now questioning how such an attack would help Donald Trump while the United States is dealing with political uncertainty over who will control the White House for the next 4 years following a contested election. Donald Trump announced the United States' withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018 and launched his so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran by unilaterally reimposing sanctions on the country. His stance on Iran has been repeatedly criticized internationally, including even by the closest U.S. allies. But Tehran has warned that any aggression by the U.S. against Iran, be it Trump's attempt to distract the American public in the aftermath of the November 3rd election, or an excuse to stay in power, will certainly be met with a crushing response.
Russia says the United States has deceived Moscow, and the international community after it conducted an advanced intercontinental missile interception test. Russia's foreign ministry says the exercise used technology that is part of the Aegis Ashore missile defense system, which the Pentagon had assured the Kremlin was not aimed at Russia's long-range capabilities. A Russian foreign ministry spokesperson has described the development as quote-unquote a new confirmation of the dangerous and destabilizing character of Washington's anti-ballistic missile strategy and, quote, obvious anti-Russian orientation. Maria Zakharova says the test proved the falsity of American statements, saying, quote, for many years, America assured us that the interception of Russian ICBMs by American standard systems, including this modification, is technically impossible. There are fears the test risks paving the way for Russia testing similar technologies against America's intercontinental ballistic missiles. Moscow has already stated that it reserves the right to take the necessary response measure. On Monday, the U.S. military used the new advanced technology to fire, for the first time, a missile from a warship which downed an ICBM. Previously, the U.S. had promoted the weapon system as being limited against short and intermediate-range missile threats. Russia says this is direct evidence and a concrete example of how Washington manipulated public opinion of its country, lied to its international partners, and justified its actions in the international arena with far-fetched pretexts. Following the collapse of the INF and before the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, the only remaining U.S.-Russian nuclear arms control agreement, New START, is also, as things stand, set to expire early next year. Moscow says it hasn't closed the door on negotiations to extend the agreement, formerly known as the New Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. The projected U.S. presidential election winner, Joe Biden, has previously said he will explore the treaty's extension without conditions. However, bilateral relations between the two countries have always been on very shaky grounds. Analysts say the latest American missile test will only escalate military tensions. Amid Russia's worsening relations with NATO, it could not have come at a worse time. Questions have been raised as to whether the U.S. may use the system against Russian military interests. The weapon used to down the ICBM, the Standard Missile 3 or SM-3, is part of the Aegis Ballistic Missile Defense System. Moscow has long suspected the system to be a major pathway to a U.S. global missile shield to undermine Russia's military power. The SM-3 missiles have also been deployed close to Russian soil, in Poland and Romania. Moscow says it has repeatedly warned it would take similar measures to ensure national security and maintain a strategic stability. Essentially, that means more sophisticated weapon systems deployed by the adversaries, while suspicions between the U.S. on the one hand and Russia and China on the other spiral out of control.
Bahrain's top diplomat on an official visit to Israel, breaking a long-time taboo. Foreign Minister Abdel Latif Al-Zayani landed in Israel on Wednesday. His controversial trip this week marks the first such visit to Israel by any official from the tiny Persian Gulf Kingdom. Al-Zayani's trip coincides with a visit to Israel by America's top diplomat Mike Pompeo. The Bahraini delegation went on to occupy Jerusalem al-Quds. The top Bahraini diplomat sat down for talks with senior Israeli officials, including his counterpart Gabi Ashkenazi and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The U.S. Secretary of State was apparently there to facilitate the controversial rapprochement. Al-Zayani's trip, which has angered the Palestinians, is part of a U.S.-backed push to normalize ties between the two sides.
It is obvious that the Trump administration wants to make sure that the normalization process and the what they used to call the deal of the century will be very crucial and strong before they get away from the power in January. So they are doing marathonian steps so that everything will be on the ground and will be very much clear laid out.
Palestinian groups denounced the trilateral meeting between the U.S., Bahrain and Israel as a clear attack on the rights of the Palestinian people. The Palestinians want all Arab nations to refrain from establishing ties with Israel until the Israeli occupation is over and a Palestinian state becomes a reality. But as part of a U.S. brokered initiative, Bahrain and its Persian Gulf neighbor, the United Arab Emirates, signed normalization accords with Israel at the White House in mid-September. Sudan has also agreed to normalize ties with Israel as part of a deal that will guarantee much-needed U.S. financial aid. Israel has escalated its violations in the occupied territories over the past years. For instance, it has stepped up settlement construction on occupied lands. The regime has also stepped up demolition of Palestinian homes. So far this year, nearly 700 structures have been razed to the ground across the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem Al-Quds. The UN says that number is more than the figure in any full year since 2016. Palestinians have widely blamed the worsening situation on policies pursued by the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. The American president makes no secret of his extremely pro-Israel stance. Trump took the American support for the regime to a whole new level by moves such as recognizing Jerusalem al-Quds as Israel's capital. Palestinian groups now say the U.S.-backed push to normalize ties between several Arab states and Israel is further emboldening the regime. How can Palestinians now trust the U.S. as it loudly brands itself as a mediator between them and Israel? Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today as several Arab states are abandoning the cause and normalizing their ties with Israel. Palestinians say these Arab states are stabbing them in the back. Palestinians know all too well that their options are very limited at the moment. As many governments refuse to pressure the Israeli regime, the people of Palestine are hoping popular grassroots campaigns against Israel will one day change things for the better.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The U.S. President-elect Joe Biden will nominate the veteran diplomat Antony Blinken as his Secretary of State and Linda Thomas Greenfield as Ambassador to the United Nations, moving forward to implement a campaign pledge. Blinken and Thomas Greenfield bring deep foreign policy backgrounds to the nascent administration while providing a sharp contrast with Donald Trump, who distrusted such experience and embraced an America First policy that strained long-standing U.S. relationships. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Julian Borgia. The piece is titled, Joe Biden to nominate Antony Blinken as U.S. Secretary of State. Please stay with us for more of Julian Borgia's article. U.S. President-elect Joe Biden will nominate the veteran diplomat Antony Blinken as his Secretary of State and Linda Thomas-Greenfield as Ambassador to the United Nations, moving forward to implement a campaign pledge. Antony Blinken and Linda Thomas-Greenfield bring deep foreign policy backgrounds to the nascent administration while providing a sharp contrast with Donald Trump, who distrusted such experience and embraced an America First policy that strained long-standing U.S. relationships. Blinken could be named as early as next Tuesday, according to sources close to Joe Biden, whilst the Axios website first reported Linda Thomas-Greenfield's impending nomination. Blinken's appointment made another longtime Biden aide and foreign policy veteran Jake Sullivan the top candidate to be U.S. National Security Advisor, according to a source who told the Reuters news agency. During the campaign, Joe Biden severely criticized Donald Trump's go-it-alone foreign policy and pledged to recommit to NATO and to other global pacts, whilst promising to tap experts to fight the COVID-19 crisis and other problems at home. He has promised to rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement and the World Health Organization, WHO, and potentially the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. America First has made America alone, Joe Biden said in a town hall meeting in October. Antony Blinken is a longtime Biden confidant who served as number two at the State Department and as Deputy National Security Advisor in Barack Obama's administration, in which Joe Biden served as Vice President. Linda Thomas-Greenfield, a black woman who served as the Assistant Secretary of State for Africa under Barack Obama, was intended to restore morale and help fulfill Joe Biden's pledge to choose a diverse cabinet, the Axios website reported. Jake Sullivan served as Joe Biden's National Security Advisor during the Obama administration and also as Deputy Chief of Staff to the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Ron Klain, Joe Biden's choice as White House Chief of Staff, told ABC's This Week program that the first Biden cabinet picks would come on Tuesday. Joe Biden said last week he had settled on a Treasury Secretary, the former Federal Reserve Chairman. Janet Yellen is believed to be the top candidate in Democratic and monetary policy circles. A spokesman for Joe Biden's transition team declined to comment. Ron Klain again urged that the Trump administration, specifically a federal agency called the General Services Administration, GSA, formally recognized Biden's victory in order to unlock resources for the transition process. Joe Biden is due to take office on 20th of January. A record number of Americans rejected the Trump presidency, and since then Donald Trump has been rejecting democracy, Ron Klain told This Week. Since Biden, a Democrat, was declared the winner of the election 2 weeks ago, Trump has launched a barrage of lawsuits and mounted a pressure campaign to try to prevent state officials from certifying their vote totals, suffering another emphatic legal setback on Saturday in Pennsylvania. Joe Biden received 6 million more votes nationwide than Donald Trump and prevailed 306 to 232 in the state-by-state electoral college system that determines the election's victor. Ron Klain said there would be scaled-down versions of the existing traditions for Biden's inauguration. Inauguration ceremonies and related events typically draw huge crowds to Washington. COVID-19 cases and deaths are surging in many parts of the country amid a pandemic that has killed more than 256,000 Americans. Critics of Donald Trump, including Democrats and some Republicans, have accused him of trying to undermine faith in the American electoral system and delegitimize Joe Biden's victory by promoting false claims of widespread voter fraud.
Around the world with reporters.
The Gaza Strip has logged more than 15,000 COVID-19 infections and over 65 deaths, mostly since late August. Since Thursday, around 3,000 infections were detected in the impoverished enclave. Hospitals in Gaza currently have less than 100 ICU beds and ventilators for nearly 2 million inhabitants. 80% of ventilators for coronavirus patients have already been taken up. The World Health Organization cautioned that within a week, the health system in Gaza may become unable to care for critical cases.
The situation is becoming extremely dangerous in Gaza amid the rapid increase of coronavirus infections, and people here will continue to suffer. The health sector is already fragile and in a very bad shape because of the Israeli blockade. The health system will soon be unable to deal with the coronavirus pandemic and other health needs.
Despite the increasing number of coronavirus infections, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medical equipment.
Israel has systematically destroyed Gaza's health system and almost paralyzed its ability to provide health services by refusing to allow in vital medical equipment amid the apathy of the international community. Unfortunately, some Arab regimes are normalizing ties with Israel and encouraging it to perpetrate more crimes against the Palestinian people.
Local authorities have been desperately fighting to prevent the devastating outbreak of COVID-19. According to Palestinian officials, the Israeli blockade imposed on Gaza is one of the main reasons why tackling the deadly pandemic is particularly difficult.
The blockade has taken its toll on all aspects of life in Gaza, especially on the health system. The health system is struggling with the logistics, lack of medical equipment, as well as testing kits for the virus and hospital ventilators to keep patients alive.
Rights groups warn that Gaza is facing a catastrophic situation under the watchful eye of the international community.
Experts say Israel's illegal practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians, making it extremely difficult to combat the pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Cafes, restaurants in Catalonia are back in business after a prolonged coronavirus shutdown that impacted thousands of businesses, pushing angry workers out on the streets in protest. Following a sustained decrease in the daily number of COVID-19 cases, the regional government scrambled to improve a plan to reopen the economy unveiled last week by increasing operating hours and adding concert halls to the list of businesses that can reopen.
We are very happy to be back to work and hope this is the last time we shut down because it will be the end for our business. I cried every day when I was out of work because I have a family to feed. We are worried. We can't fail this time.
Under the new guidelines, food service businesses are able to operate indoors at 30% occupancy, while they can serve at full capacity on terraces, provided they keep a 2-meter distance between tables. The 4-phase reopening is expected to last 2 months, with a gradual lifting of restrictions on movement inside of the Spanish northeastern region. A 10 p.m. curfew will stay in place for several weeks as the situation in hospitals and intensive care units remains critical. Meanwhile, authorities have launched massive antigen testing campaigns across the region in a bid to control the spread of the virus.
The antigen rapid test detects the COVID-19 virus using a nasal swab. It offers a highly reliable result within 15 minutes, and it is one of the most cost-effective tests on the market right now.
Although test sensitivity for rapid antigen testing is generally lower than for the standard PCR, authorities are pushing for their deployment, arguing they could be useful in detecting highly infectious people. With a population of 7.5 million, Catalonia has registered over 300,000 cases of COVID-19 and over 15,000 deaths since the start of the pandemic.
The reopening of the economy in Catalonia is fraught with its fair share of risk and reward for everyone involved. It will take at least 2 weeks to find out if the second shot at the virus was successful. The stakes for the food service, hospitality, entertainment, and sports industries have never been higher. Kusai Kadri, Barcelona.
Some 120 kilometers from Srinagar, the summer capital of Indian-administered Kashmir, lies Uri. The line of control that divides Kashmir into two parts and ruled by India and Pakistan runs through this area of Baramulla district of Indian-held Kashmir. After trekking around 10 to 15 minutes, you reach the Smurthal village, which is frequently a target of India-Pakistan animosity. Parvez Ahmed's house was completely destroyed in the recent India-Pakistan face-off, although his family was lucky enough to survive this devastating attack.
This is not new for the people who live near the LOC, but this time it was a rain of artillery. Years of my toil is wasted. I and my family of five are homeless now in this winter. The fire even burned the food stock that I had stocked up for the winter months.
Weeks have passed since the incident. Parvez is still waiting for help and relief work to begin.
We have repeatedly asked the government to build bunkers for the people living in this area. The government is not paying attention to our needs.
The Jammu and Kashmir administration is working on a project to construct 44 bunkers for people living along the line of control. They said that another project for building some 250 individual bunkers is underway.
Whenever we go to government officials with a request, they often turn us away. Many times they say, go and seek help from Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Whatever is being said about help and relief is a media stunt, a part of which might reach us but too late.
For decades, Kashmiris have been bearing the brunt of India-Pakistan animosity. The two countries have fought two of their three wars over Kashmir, which they rule in parts but claim in its entirety. Kashmir has lost tens of thousands of people after the armed struggle against Indian rule began in 1989. India accuses Pakistan of training and sending fighters into Indian side of Kashmir, something Pakistan denies but says it only supports the idea of free and unified Kashmir, politically and diplomatically. The question that remains is how long will Parvez and many others like Parvez wait for government's assistance? Can they survive this harsh winter without a proper shelter? And how long will it take the world to stand for the resolution of this long-pending dispute without further destruction? Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
As the European Council is set to convene in December to discuss the tensions with Turkey, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has called for dialogue but warned the EU not to become a tool for enmities during escalating tensions over the Eastern Mediterranean. In his latest statement on Turkey-EU ties, Erdogan said Turkey sees its future in Europe and mentioned Turkey's post-pandemic plans to improve judicial infrastructure and strengthen the economy and other reforms.
We see ourselves as an inseparable part of Europe, with which we share 600 years of historical bond. We are calling on the EU to create a closer bond with us, to keep the promise of full membership for Turkey. We see ourselves in Europe, not anywhere else. We aim to build our future with Europe.
Observers, however, say Turkey does not stand any chance to become an EU member, despite all negotiations.
In my opinion, the EU does not see Turkey either as a partner or a possible member of the bloc. For the EU, Turkey is only a trade ally. This means that neither